Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Troy Littleton. Troy got his PhD and MD from Baylor College of Medicine, where he worked with Hugo Bellin, and they showed one of the original papers showing that, in Drosophila, showing that synaptotagmin is essential for calcium-activated neurotransmitter release. He then went and did a postdoc with Barry Ganetsky at the University of Wisconsin, and continued to work in Drosophila on the presynaptic side, and looked at the snare complex and showed its importance for exocytosis. And then finally, in 2000, he joined the Department of Biology in the Picower Institute of Learning and Memory at MIT, where he just recently gained tenure. Troy's got a number of awards, including a Sloan Fellowship. And now his lab continues to look, use Drosophila and look at vesicle release and synaptotagmin and the snare complex, but also more recently has started to look at synapse formation and synaptic growth, and is also now using Drosophila as a model for looking at some of the human diseases such as Huntington's and muscular dystrophy. So.
Well, thank you, Dax, and good morning. And thank you for inviting me to tell you a little bit about some of the current work ongoing in the lab. And in particular, my lab studies synapses, the sites of information transfer in the nervous system. And we study how these synaptic connections form and how they function. And recently, we've gotten interested into plasticity. As you know, behavioral experience can modify circuitry in the nervous system to change its function. And that's thought to be due to changes either in the structure or the function of these synaptic connections. And we've been exploring that using the Drosophila neuromuscular junction as a model system. So I'm going to tell you about some of our work today using this synapse to really ask how these synapses function, how they form during development, and how activity can modify their structure in development. As most of you know, synaptic communication occurs through the release of neurotransmitters through synaptic vesicles. These neurotransmitters undergo local exo and endocytotic cycles. They dock at the plasma membrane and are primed for fusion, or they wait until an action potential propagates the nerve terminal. And once in the nerve terminal, these vesicles are triggered to fuse and release their neurotransmitters. This is a classical recording from Bernard Katz, where you can see in the absence of calcium, an action potential triggers no vesicle fusion. As you increase the concentration of calcium, the number of vesicles that fuse increase. And so it's been clear that calcium is a key mediator of synaptic communication in the brain. But in recent years, it's also been clear that calcium entry into the postsynaptic compartment during intense stimulation, for example, through NMDA subclasses of glutamate receptors, is a key trigger for plasticity in the nervous system. And although we know a lot about what calcium does in the presynaptic terminal to trigger vesicle fusion and initiate communication in the brain, much less is known about what calcium does in the postsynaptic compartment to actually trigger plasticity. Today, I'm going to tell you about some of our work looking at that in the fly neuromuscular junction and sort of the surprising finding that one of the things that calcium does postsynaptically is very similar to what it does presynaptically. That is, there's a calcium-sensitive fusion machinery present in the postsynaptic compartment that can respond to increases in calcium to release retrograde signals that can trigger changes in the way these presynaptic terminals work and ultimately can drive structural remodeling of connections. So using this Drosophila system, we can begin to look at sort of the changes between short-term plasticity and long-term rewiring of the nervous system that's thought to contribute to more long-term modifications of brain function. The model synapse that we use in the lab is the fly glutamatergic neuromuscular junction. Motor neuron cell bodies are present in the central nervous system. They send out their axons. They innervate typically single muscles, although some can innervate more than one muscle target. These connections grow dramatically throughout development of the animal. From the early larval stages to the late larval stages, there can be a tenfold increase in the number of varicosities that form. We can study each one of those varicosities at the single synapse level, where a single bouton will have multiple active zones, or T-bars are found that sort of coordinate vesicle trafficking, and fusion occurs at these particular sites. So this is a synapse that we can really begin to address some of the key components of plasticity in a defined genetic model system. And again, this is a glutamatergic synapse, so it has many of the molecules that are typically associated with plasticity in the mammalian central nervous system where glutamatergic synapses dominate. So today I want to take you through a number of questions that my lab has been asking, in particular using this fly synapse to look at basic forms of plasticity. So I'm going to show you some data that structure synaptic activity and changes in synaptic activity can in fact regulate both the structure and the function of this synapse. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on some of the work we've done in the presynaptic terminal on how calcium regulates vesicle fusion, really to set the stage for what I'll talk about mostly, and that is how postsynaptic calcium influx can trigger plasticity. I'm going to spend some time talking about the downstream effects that happen downstream of retrograde signaling. In particular, there's a change in release properties of the presynaptic neuron, and in particular, a dramatic increase in spontaneous fusion. As you know, vesicle fusion from synapses has two forms, action potential triggered evoked fusion, and in the absence of an action potential, there's spontaneous fusion. These vesicles rarely confuse with the membrane, and these are known as minis, and the function of these minis has been really unclear. And I'm going to show you that, in fact, these minis seem to be highly regulated by activity and appear to drive synaptic growth at this synapse, and I'll take you through some of that biology. So one of the big pushes in the mammalian field, as you know, has been looking at genetic manipulations that allow us to alter activity in the nervous system in a conditional fashion. And luckily in the fly, we've had these type of tools around for some time. And we've used these tools to look essentially to alter neuronal activity in an activity-dependent way. And this just shows some wild-type flies running around at 38. Flies are cold-blooded animals, so if you shift them to the temperature, their body temperature will sort of adapt to that temperature. These are some temperature-sensitive conditional mutations that essentially trigger seizure activity in the nervous system and allow us to change the activity of the brain just by shifting the fly's temperature. So this is a very powerful way in the fly to conditionally control activity. And as you can see, a wild-type fly, when you change the temperature to 38, there's really not a dramatic change in activity, whereas in these seizure mutations that we and other labs have isolated, when you shift the temperature, you can dramatically alter the function of a single protein. If that protein is involved in membrane excitability, you can cause these seizure events to happen. And that gives us very powerful tools to look at how activity changes in the nervous system can structurally affect synapses over the long term. This is a typical Drosophila life cycle, and so we took advantage of these different mutations to essentially give these animals some developmental heat shocks a couple hours a day throughout development and really look at how a short-term increase in activity over a few hours played itself out over the development of these synaptic connections. This is a typical wild-type animal that's been heat shocked. This is a particular synapse that we study, muscle fiber 6-7, and these are five different seizure mutations, all affecting different gene products. In the absence of a seizure, their terminals look very similar to this, but once you give these animals these developmental seizures, you can see a dramatic rewiring that occurs. There's more branches that forms, there are more boutons that form in these mutant animals. And so clearly activity can drive structural changes in the fly neuromuscular junction, and indeed many labs have observed this in the fly using a variety of different tools to control activity. But that really gives us a very powerful genetic model now to ask what is the link between activity changes in neurons and structural rewiring in the nervous system, something that's not very well clear really in any system. So what about the physiological changes that occurred as a response to activity? So these are some recordings that we've done at the fly embryonic neuromuscular junction where we place a patch electrode onto the muscle fiber and stimulate the nerve fiber. Early in development, these muscles that we record from have about 6 to 8 boutons that are formed in this initial synaptic field. Each one of these boutons will have 2 or 3 active zones. So it's a very small number of release sites that we record from. And indeed, if one sort of looks at activity in the absence of any stimulation, one sees very rare spontaneous fusion events known as minis. However, if we give a strong stimulus, a typical LTP-inducing stimulus, for example, we see a very dramatic change in the way the synapse works. So whereas prior to a stimulus, there's very little spontaneous fusion, after we give a robust stimulation to the nerve, the synapse dramatically changes the way it works, and now we see for several minutes a huge increase in spontaneous fusion. This fusion takes about 20 seconds to crank up. It peaks at 2 to 3 minutes, and over the course of the next 4 or 5 minutes, will begin to decay back down. So it's a very short-term change in release properties at these neuromuscular junctions that is activity-dependent. Now, the surprise came in sort of trying to dissect the molecular mechanisms of how this plasticity was manifested. And in particular, it became clear that this was requiring some type of retrograde signaling at the synapse. If you put a calcium chelator such as BAFTA into the patch electrode to block calcium entry through these glutamate receptors, you can essentially abolish this long-lasting change in spontaneous release properties at these synapses. And again, that's graphed here, suggesting that indeed there's some signal that's being triggered through calcium influx postsynaptically that drives presynaptic changes. And again, I just want to make this distinction between evoked responses and spontaneous fusion. Evoked responses are due to action potential driven fusion. And what we find here is once we give a strong burst of these action potentials, in the absence of any other stimulation, we turn on spontaneous fusion at these synapses. It's been known for a long time that we can genetically separate evoked release from spontaneous release. So it's been clear that these two pathways can be separately controlled, and I'm going to show you some data a little bit later in the talk, in fact, looking at the molecular machinery that controls the spontaneous release and sort of figuring out if it plays a biological role at synapses. We know a little bit more about how this retrograde signaling synapse works as well. During the strong application of a stimulus, the calcium-induced change in retrograde signaling appears to talk to the cyclic AMP pathway. So we can mimic this with forskolin, an activator of adenylate cyclase, or we can dramatically increase spontaneous release at the synapse. Indeed, this is a universal function of forskolin. You dump this on essentially any synapse, including mammalian synapses, you get this dramatic change in spontaneous release rates, suggesting that pKa may be involved in this pathway. And indeed, if you look at mutations in Drosophila pKa in the synaptic variant, a mutant called DCO, when you give this high-frequency stimulation, this long-lasting change in spontaneous fusion is completely abolished. So that sort of led to the general model that the way retrograde signaling is working at these fly synapses is during a strong stimulus, calcium influx drives the release of a retrograde signal that activates pKa, and that leads to a modification in release properties over a short time window. And that sort of brings me to the next question of what is it that calcium does that triggers postsynaptic plasticity? This is a question that's ongoing in the mammalian field in models such as long-term potentiation and long-term depression, where calcium influx through NMDA-type subunits of the glutamate receptor are critical for triggering plasticity. And sort of to tell you what we think calcium is doing, I'm going to take a brief detour to give you a little bit of background on what calcium does in the presynaptic nerve terminal. There, we've done a lot of work to figure out precisely how calcium controls vesicle fusion. And as I'll show you in a minute, that same molecular pathway with different molecular components appears to be at work in the postsynaptic side as well. So vesicle fusion has been studied for many years, and it's known that the core molecular machinery that drives the fusion of two membranes, in this case the synaptic vesicle membrane with the plasma membrane, is due to the formation of a molecular complex called the snare complex. These are the snare proteins syntaxin, synaptobrevin, and SNAP25, which are the molecular targets of the clostridial neurotoxins tetanus and botulinum, which cleave these proteins and can block fusion. So this core molecular machine, in fact, works at vesicle fusion events throughout the cell, ER to Golgi, Golgi to plasma membrane. And what synapses have done is essentially to evolve specific molecular adapters that can change the way this snare complex works. And one of those adapters that I'll tell you about is a molecule called synaptotagmin. This is a single synaptic vesicle transmembrane protein. It has two motifs that bind calcium. When this molecule binds calcium, it engages lipid bilayers, and it also increases affinity for the snare complex. And that's thought to be an important molecular trigger for fusion. And one can kinetically measure these C2 domains, as they're called, these calcium-binding motifs. When you add calcium to this molecule, it very rapidly will dive into a lipid bilayer. When you take calcium away, it very rapidly will dive out. So it seems to be this lipid-binding machine that jumps in and out of membranes in a calcium-dependent way, making it an attractive candidate for being the presynaptic calcium sensor. And a number of laboratories, including my own, have done extensive genetic analysis of this molecule, and essentially the basic phenotype one sees at both fly and mammalian synapses is that following an action potential in a wild-type animal, there's a robust number of vesicle fusion events. This particular synapse, there's about 10 vesicles that fuse. All of them fuse very rapidly. And in synaptotagmin 1 null mutants, when you take this molecule away, fusion can still occur, but usually you'll get a single vesicle fusion event, if at all, and that fusion event is delayed from the action potential. And this is a phase of release known as asynchronous release, and this is just a plot of the latency following stimulation. In a wild-type synapse, all vesicle fusion events essentially happen within a millisecond, and in synaptotagmin mutants, they essentially happen very slowly, and there's a reduced number. And that's led to a general molecular model that there are two presynaptic calcium sensors, synaptotagmin 1, which drives this very fast phase of release, and then an asynchronous calcium sensor that controls a more slower phase of release. And through a lot of molecular studies, there's been a basic model for how this synaptotagmin protein binds calcium through its C2 domains and triggers molecular fusion. So the presynaptic side of the story has been partially worked out, at least, and there's a framework of a molecular model. Now, what sort of allowed us to stumble on the general finding that this mechanism might be employed in the postsynaptic compartment was when we began looking for this asynchronous calcium sensor. There's been wide speculation in the field that the asynchronous calcium sensor might be another member of this synaptotagmin family. This turns out to be a large protein family with many isoforms, and it's always been suggested that another isoform could mediate this sort of second component of presynaptic calcium-dependent release. And so that brings me to sort of the third point I want to make on the role of postsynaptic calcium influx in triggering plasticity. And again, the way we got into this was to take advantage of the fly system to go in and essentially knock out all the Drosophila synaptotagmin molecules looking for this asynchronous calcium sensor, because our impression at the time was that all the synaptotagmins were going to be presynaptic, involved in some type of presynaptic vesicle fusion. And in fact, there are multiple members of the family. This is just a dendrogram. The Drosophila ones are shown here in bold. But there are two isoforms that are universally conserved throughout the published genomes of animals with nervous systems. That's synaptotagmin 1, the isoform that I've shown you that plays a critical role in synaptic vesicle fusion, and an isoform called synaptotagmin 4. And as I'll show you in a minute, these are the only two isoforms, indeed, that are universally present in all synapses. The other isoforms are present in very distinct subsets of neurons where they play a role in dense core vesicle fusion in unique neuronal subpopulations. So a graduate student in the lab, Billa Dolphson, began sort of characterizing, making mutations in all these synaptotagmins. And this is just an in situ showing a localization of these within the fly nervous system. And the only point that I want to make is that only two genes, SIT1 and SIT4, are present in every neuron. So this is the central nervous system. This is the peripheral nervous system. SIT4 is also expressed in muscle fibers, as I'll show you in a minute. It's a little bit darker staining that you see there. The other isoforms are expressed in very specific subpopulations of neurons. So that really focused our attention on these two particular isoforms with the general idea that maybe this SIT4 isoform might be this asynchronous calcium sensor. But the real surprise came when we localized this molecule at fly synapses. So this is a general molecular marker of the fly presynaptic membrane, where you can see the highlight of the individual boutons. This is immunoreactivity against synaptotagmin 1. And as you would expect for a protein on synaptic vesicles, this immunoreactivity is present inside the nerve terminal. The surprise is when we localize synaptotagmin 4, it has a very distinct localization in synaptotagmin 1, and in fact, it highlights vesicles that are present not in the presynaptic nerve terminal, but rather postsynaptically in the postsynaptic muscle. And you can see that at higher magnification here, where you have an individual bouton and these postsynaptic vesicular structures that are labeled and sort of highlight every single bouton, suggesting that this particular isoform is present in the postsynaptic compartment. So that led to a general molecular model that perhaps the way calcium is mediating plasticity postsynaptically might be through similar mechanisms that occur presynaptically. That is, might calcium drive the fusion of this subpopulation of vesicles? And one sort of looks at this by EM, which we're sort of in the process of perfecting, but it's clear that this population of vesicles is much smaller. It's more like a dense core vesicle pool than the pool that you see in the presynaptic terminal, so there's far less vesicles here. But might it be that what calcium is doing is to drive this postsynaptic exocytosis to release some type of a retrograde signal? So we first wanted to begin to test this molecular model by looking at these postsynaptic vesicles. Very little is known about these structures in the brain, and actually whether they respond to calcium, whether they undergo fusion with the membrane was not known. And so we wanted to begin to test that. Do these postsynaptic vesicles behave anything like presynaptic vesicles and fuse in a calcium-dependent way? And so we took advantage of several tricks that we have in Drosophila to manipulate synapses. And one of those is the dominant negative inhibitor of endocytosis, Shibiri. This is a mutant form of dynamine that blocks endocytosis. And we can genetically put this in either the pre- or postsynaptic compartment in the fly by using either neuronal drivers or muscle drivers and taking advantage of the fly UAS-Gal4 system. So what we've done in the next experiment I'll show you is to essentially express this dominant negative inhibitor of endocytosis in the postsynaptic compartment and then to stimulate the synapse and essentially ask, do these vesicles undergo fusion with the plasma membrane? And in the absence of dynamine function, they should get trapped there, and we should see a redistribution of these vesicles from their localization normally to a localization where they're trapped in the plasma membrane. That experiment is shown here. So we're, again, expressing Shibiri only in the postsynaptic compartment. Presynaptic communication is intact. And again, you see this halo of vesicles around individual synapses. If we raise the temperature, block endocytosis, and now stimulate, you can see that this pool of vesicles that's normally there is depleted. And instead, we see immunoreactivity for SIT4 overlapping the plasma membrane. So all these vesicles have collapsed into the plasma membrane during a strong stimulus. You allow the stimulus block to recover at room temperature, all these vesicles will pop back out. And if you leave out calcium, the vesicles won't fuse. So again, at least they behave similarly to what we see for presynaptic vesicle fusion. And then to sort of directly demonstrate that these vesicles fuse with the muscle plasma membrane, we took advantage of special variants of GFP that are pH sensitive, the fluorines, which you may have heard about, which are a common tool for following synaptic vesicle exocytosis. Typically, if you place these pH-sensitive GFPs in a synaptic vesicle protein, inside the acidic lumen of the vesicle, they won't fluoresce. If you stimulate upon exocytosis, they will fluoresce as you expose this epitope to the basal synaptic cleft. So we took advantage of this strategy and labeled synaptotagmin 4 specifically with a fluorine pH-sensitive GFP and expressed it only in the postsynaptic muscle. And what you can see is, in fact, these postsynaptic vesicles do fuse. You can see these subdomains where postsynaptic vesicle fusion occurs within a single bouton. And if you look at this in more detail, again, this is a single-fly bouton where we've labeled up the individual presynaptic active zones. And what you can see is these postsynaptic vesicles are fusing right near where presynaptic active zones are present, again, suggesting that whatever signal they might be releasing could directly influence release properties. And in fact, if you look at markers for the postsynaptic density, this fusion event is happening very close to the postsynaptic density. People always ask us, well, is this some specific effect at the fly neuromuscular junction? Is postsynaptic fusion occurring, for example, in CNS neurons? We've begun to explore that as well in Drosophila. Using, for example, drivers with the synaptotagmin 4 fluorine, we can now putatively follow postsynaptic exocytosis in real time, although it's a bit tricky with a small number of vesicles that fuse. But this just shows expression in a fly motor neuron, where it sends its axon out into the periphery to innervate the muscle fiber. And it has dendritic connections that occur within the central nervous system arbor, where it receives its input. If one looks at where this CYT4 fluorine goes during activity in CNS neurons, we see, again, these dendritic trees lit up, but the presynaptic terminal is not lit up. So certainly within motor neurons, where we know the dendritic axonal structure in the fly, CYT4 vesicles fuse in dendrites as well. So this is likely to be a general event, not something specific to the fly neuromuscular junction. So that leads us to the general question now. We know these calcium-dependent fusion events happen in the postsynaptic compartment. What is their biological relevance? Do they actually contribute to any of the plasticity events that I showed you earlier? So the first thing we did was to generate a synaptotagmin 4 knockout mutant in the fly. And what we found is that when you look at plasticity in this particular mutant, this long-lasting change in release properties that I showed you earlier following a high-frequency stimulus is completely abolished. If we make a rescue construct for CYT4 and put it back only in the postsynaptic compartment, so it's being driven specifically in the muscle, we can fully rescue this plasticity event. And in contrast, if we put this in the presynaptic nerve terminal, we now can't rescue this at all. So clearly, this is a requirement for postsynaptic synaptotagmin and calcium-dependent vesicular trafficking events that trigger long-lasting changes in presynaptic release properties. We think this functions very similar to synaptotagmin 1. If you mutate these calcium binding sites so the molecule can't bind calcium and you put it into the postsynaptic compartment, it fails to rescue. We can block trafficking in the postsynaptic compartment using different tricks as well. One of the tricks that I've already showed you is this Shibiri mutation, which we can dominantly express in the muscle fiber. And this just shows a reversible change in this event. This is not a developmental event, if you will. So this is now in a Shibiri animal that we've put the Shibiri transgene only in the muscle. We've raised the temperature and giving high-frequency stimulus. And if you block these postsynaptic vesicle recyclings, you see very little plasticity. It doesn't completely abolish it like the CYT4 mutant does, but it severely reduces. The exact same animal, if you drop the temperature back down and now allow this postsynaptic vesicle fusion to occur, you get very robust plasticity. So this doesn't appear to be just a developmental change in the way the synaptic structure is organized in a CYT4 mutant, but rather an acute requirement for these CYT4 vesicles. So what I've shown you so far is that at the fly neuromuscular junction, calcium influx can drive the fusion of postsynaptic vesicles, and this postsynaptic retrograde signaling event is required for a change in release properties in the presynaptic terminal. And you may remember that we sort of worked a little bit out on the molecular mechanism on the presynaptic side to identify cyclic AMP as a key effector molecule. And so we were interested in looking at how that release event was regulated. In particular, the finding that was really the short-term change was a change in mini-frequency, not so much an evoked release. And that was a bit striking and a bit different from forms of mammalian plasticity, where short-term changes in evoked responses are thought to be critical. Whether these short-term changes in mini-frequencies were important for a long-lasting plasticity event was unclear. And so we wanted to look at some more of these presynaptic mechanisms that might be downstream of PKA that could regulate specifically spontaneous fusion at synapses. So spontaneous fusion at synapses is a relative mystery. There's not much known in terms of what regulates these spontaneous vesicle fusion events. One of the things in sort of thinking about the synaptic vesicle cycle that clearly can be involved is the presynaptic calcium channel. If you were to modify the function of the presynaptic calcium channel and allow calcium in, you can increase these fusion rates. And then the other sort of thing that we thought about that might be important was the molecular identity that's been referred to as a fusion clamp. So one of the unique features of synaptic vesicle cycling compared to, for example, ER to Golgi cycling is once vesicles undergo the endocytotic retrieval, they have to essentially dock and prime and wait in these prime states. Most fusion events from the ER to Golgi, once it's targeted, those vesicles just fuse right away. It's synapses you really need that vesicle to hold itself into a position where calcium can then trigger the fusion event. And that's led to a general hypothesis that there's a molecular fusion clamp that grabs the vesicle after this priming and just holds it in that state until a calcium signal triggers fusion. And if one were to modify the properties of the fusion clamp, you could imagine increasing the rate of spontaneous fusion independent of any change in calcium or evoke signaling. So in terms of thinking about the molecular fusion clamp, there's a couple of proteins that came out, and in particular proteins that directly interact with the SNARE complex, this molecular machine that drives fusion, are good candidates. And one of those proteins, in fact, have been shown to be highly phosphorylated by pKa in the mammalian brain. Very few proteins are known in the brain to bind to the assembled SNARE complex, and one of them is a small molecule called complexin. Okay? And the fact that this protein was highly phosphorylated by pKa in a study that was really directed at tau, but this came out of a mass spec screen, suggested that this protein might be an interesting target to think about. Now, complexin, in fact, has been studied quite a bit. It's one of the few proteins in the brain that stoichiometrically binds the SNARE complex in a one-to-one fashion. And in fact, it's been co-crystallized with the SNARE complex. It's this pink molecule right here. It's about 120 amino acids, very small, has a cold-cold structure, and essentially binds to a fold in the SNARE complex. Okay? So this was an interesting molecule to think about in terms of modifying fusion at synapses. And what made it particularly exciting was some recent biochemical work from Jim Rothman's group and a postdoc from Jim's lab, Jim McNew, who's gone on to have his own lab, looking at the biochemistry of SNARE fusion in vitro. So Jim, as you know, sort of identified the original SNARE complex story with NSF and has been doing a lot of this work in vitro to sort of essentially look at the role of SNARES in driving fusion in a test tube. And so Jim, using sort of SNARES that were expressed on the surface of cells, was able to show that if you incubate complexin, the small molecule, in the same test tube, you could prevent fusion of these cells. So it seemed to reduce fusion in vitro. And Jim McNew, using actually the Drosophila homolog of complexin, made another exciting discovery in a test tube where it looked like, in fact, what complexin was doing to block fusion was to block interleaflet mixing. So this has sort of been a debated concept in the presynaptic vesicle trafficking field in terms of whether a hemifused state might exist. But the general idea is we know during fusion you have to fuse the outer leaflets first, and then in the second phase fuse the inner leaflets in order to get a fusion pore. And there's been speculation that you might be able to sort of clamp fusion at this hemifused state that might lead to the very rapid microsecond fusion that goes on in the brain. And in fact, in lipid mixing experiments, when they were looking at the fusion of liposomes, the addition of complexin sort of arrested this hemifusion state. So again, this was all interesting biochemical data that suggested this small molecule is clearly a pKa target in mammals and might be involved in regulating this fusion clamp property of synapses and could be a target for regulating presynaptic release, spontaneous vesicle fusion. So we explored this in more detail using our fly model. Drosophila has a highly conserved pKa phosphorylation site right near the SNARE binding motif of complexin. These pKa motifs are essentially defined by these two charged residues upstream of the threonine site. This was a very exciting site to us right off the bat because it turns out that mammalian isoforms, there are four mammalian complexin isoforms. Two of those are universally found at most synapses, and two isoforms, complexin 3 and 4, are only found at one very specific synapse in the brain, and that is the bipolar synapse, the synapse between photoreceptors and bipolar neurons. In fact, that's the only synapse in the brain that's known to use minis as a form of synaptic communication. In the dark, those photoreceptors fuse vesicles all the time. And in those two complexin isoforms, this amino acid has a phosphomimetic aspartate there. So that really clued us in that there's probably something exciting going on with that particular residue that might control spontaneous fusion in the brain. Okay? So we went on to show, in fact, that this particular protein is phosphorylated by pKa. This is just phosphorylation assays of the Drosophila protein. We made antibodies to characterize where this protein was localized. Fly complexin is beautifully present in the presynaptic compartment. Here you see a marker of the postsynaptic PSD. Complexin is present inside the presynaptic nerve terminal, so it's clearly restricted to presynaptic nerve terminals. We made mutations in complexin and look at their properties. If one looks at evoked responses in the mutant, what we find is that there are defects in evoked responses, but they're relatively mild compared to controls. However, what was striking is looking at spontaneous fusion. So release of events that happen in the absence of an action potential. These are now recordings from the third instar synapse, where you can see these individual fusion events. This is an animal that's been rescued with a complexin transgene in the presynaptic neuron, and this is a complexin mutant. Essentially, this is one of the most dramatic phenotypes I've ever seen as a fly physiologist. Essentially, all hell is broken loose, and vesicles are fusing all the time. So it's this massive presynaptic exocytosis that occurs that essentially you get a 100-fold increase in release rates in these complexin mutations. So it's a dramatic change in spontaneous fusion, consistent with the idea that the role of this protein is to clamp release in the absence of the calcium signal. If you look at this in the complete absence of calcium, it's possible that maybe there's some dysregulation of the presynaptic calcium channel, but in the absence of external calcium, this high frequency of spontaneous release still occurs. So this is clearly a calcium-independent event, releasing these spontaneous vesicles. And if you make a double mutant with Shibiri, again, where we can deplete all the vesicles, prevent them from being endocytosed, at room temperature, you again see this massive exocytosis. You raise the temperature and stimulate, you deplete all these vesicles, you completely eliminate all the spontaneous release. So this is clearly a dramatic increase in minis in this particular mutant through the release of vesicles in a calcium-independent fashion. There's some interesting structural considerations. Ling Yang was sort of talking this morning about bulk endocytosis. One of the things that we see in these complexin mutant terminals is, in fact, they have a large increase in these large membranous events that are characteristic of bulk endocytosis, suggesting that, indeed, there's some interesting biology going on. All the spontaneous fusion is driving a unique phase of endocytosis at these synapses. That's really not relevant. And then overexpression of complexin does exactly the opposite. So if we increase the amount of complexin, we can dramatically prevent the normal rates of spontaneous fusion of this synapse. So this is really a molecule whose function appears to be regulate spontaneous fusion in a presynaptic specific fashion, and particularly to regulate mini frequency in the nervous system. So our current molecular model for how we think about these events in the presynaptic nerve terminal is that normally, in the absence of a strong stimulus, complexin is bound to the snare complex, preventing fusion in the absence of a calcium signal. And then, upon a high-frequency stimulation event, we increase calcium influx through these glutamate receptors. We trigger this postsynaptic vesicle fusion event through CYP4. Cyclic AMP is activated. PK temporarily phosphorylates complexin. And then complexin pops off the snare complex. And now we have a state that, as long as complexin is phosphorylated, this synapse can essentially go from an off state to an on state. And now all the spontaneous vesicles will fuse. And you get this huge increase in mini frequency that essentially can be mimicked for as long as this complexin molecule is in a phosphorylated state. So a very acute way to regulate mini frequency at a synapse. Now the question is, does this really have a biological role in long-term plasticity at this synapse? And so is it the case that the structural plasticity that I showed you earlier, in terms of activity driving structural change, are any of these molecular components involved in this synaptic growth event? Might this be a way for activity, a strong activity, to tag a synapse, if you will? So there's all this been the molecular studies trying to understand how a single strong stimulus can lead to a structural rearrangement in a nerve terminal when you have no other signals. And this might be some way to think about that this sort of feedback loop where you get all this increased spontaneous release might serve to generate second messengers that could lead to long-term structural growth of these activated synapses. So we were interested in exploring the link between these molecules and synaptic growth. So I'm going to walk you through some of this data. First, looking at the role of PKA in synaptic growth, looking at complexin mutants, and then manipulating CYP4 levels to see what effects they have on this activity-dependent synaptic growth. So it's been well known in the fly field that PKA is a critical trigger of molecular plasticity. The original learning mutants in flies, dunts and rutabaga, all affect the levels of PKA. So it's known to be a core molecule in the plasticity pathway. And in fact, dunts mutants, where there's too much cyclic AMP, have synaptic overgrowth. We can express a constitutively active version of PKA in these presynaptic motor neurons, and we can drive dramatic structural changes at these synapses as well. So there's a direct link between the activation of PKA and the formation of new boutons and varicosities at this synapse. So turning on PKA in a presynaptic neuron is, in fact, quite similar to what activity does. It drives proliferation at these synapses. What about in the complexin mutant? So in a complexin mutant, we have these animals that have this dramatic increase in minis, not much of a change in evoked response. What do their nerve terminals look like? And in fact, they have a dramatic overproliferation of synapses. So this is a control synapse. This is a complexin null mutant. And what we find essentially is almost a complete twofold increase in the number of boutons that form. So in a synapse that's just pouring out minis all the time, that synapse undergoes dramatic structural remodeling compared to control synapses. again suggesting a direct link between this increase in mini frequency and a signal that can drive synaptic growth. We also see the same things through manipulations of this postsynaptic calcium sensor. If we increase retrograde signaling by driving enhanced levels of synaptotagmin 4 postsynaptically, we see that the synapse also overproliferates, and this is in fact a dose-dependent effect, again suggesting that increasing retrograde signals can drive proliferation of the synapse. If you look in the SIT4 mutant, the opposite is true. Synaptic growth is actually affected in the opposite direction. In the absence of these retrograde signals, the synapse undergrows compared to normal. And in fact, if you looked at this early plasticity that I showed you initially, these temperature-sensitive mutations where we can ramp up synaptic growth, essentially in a wild-type animal, if we look at one of these seizure mutations, its synaptic growth is relatively normal. If we incubate this at elevated temperatures to increase activity, we get this dramatic overproliferation. If we do this manipulation in the absence of the SIT4 postsynaptic calcium sensor, there's no activity-dependent synaptic growth. So again, this suggests a direct link between this retrograde signaling pathway, this enhanced mini-frequency, and signals that ultimately drive structural proliferation at these synapses. And then one final experiment that we've done is to begin to look at whether this is, in fact, a synapse-specific change in plasticity. So one of the unique features of mammalian plasticity is a general idea that it can be Hebbian, or that it can be synapse-specific, and that neurons that are activated can specifically change this synaptic connection, but not connections that are made on other neurons that may not be active. And so this might be, in fact, a very elegant way to think about that, because you're essentially limiting plasticity induction to sites that can respond to these release retrograde signals, very much like what's going on in the presynaptic terminal. So in theory, the spread of plasticity would be limited to where these postsynaptic vesicle fusion events are occurring. And so we wanted to begin to test this in the fly. And the fly, in fact, has several nice molecular tools that allow us to do just that. There are cases where a single motor neuron, for example, the RP3 motor neuron, will innervate two different muscle fibers, in this case, muscle fibers 6 and 7. And we have genetic control over gene expression between those two muscle fibers. And so essentially, we can manipulate the levels of retrograde signaling in one postsynaptic target but not the other. For example, if we increase retrograde signaling at muscle fiber 6, does it cause this pink neuron to essentially grow everywhere? It's possible this is a general growth factor that's released that just causes growth everywhere, or does it specifically cause increase in synaptic growth only on the muscle fiber 6? So that experiment is shown in the next slide. Normally what we find, this is sort of a DIC image overlaid with a synaptic marker, and if you look at the number of synapses on muscle fiber 6 versus muscle fiber 7, and you can plot those across different experiments, normally there's about an equal number of synapses between those two fibers. If we overexpress synaptotagmin 4 in a wild-type background to increase this retrograde signaling in muscle fiber 6, we find a very different molecular event happening, and now we actually get synaptic growth on the muscle fiber 6 at the expense of synapses on muscle fiber 7. So now you essentially shift the population of synapses that form on muscle fiber 6 as though this were a competitive event. And it's even more dramatic if you do it in the SIT4 null background. This is a DIC image actually stained for the SIT4 protein, so you can actually see the SIT4 protein in muscle fiber 6 specifically. You can almost completely denervate muscle fiber 7. So what it looks like is essentially what is going on in the fly is as these early growth cones are migrating to their targets and begin to innervate them, they begin to undergo this bursting behavior, releasing neurotransmitter, and the postsynaptic targets essentially are responding back. So the postsynaptic targets that are releasing retrograde signals essentially are saying, okay, you made a right connection, and these synapses start to grow preferentially on those targets that are responding to this retrograde signaling pathway. So in summary then, I showed you some features of the drosophila neuromuscular junction that suggested, in fact, this synapse has both structural and functional plasticity. One of the surprising aspects of that plasticity is the presence of this postsynaptic fusion machinery that releases in a calcium-dependent fashion retrograde signals. We're still in the process of figuring out what all these retrograde signals are. There's a lot of biochemistry going on in the lab to try to purify these vesicles and get at the molecular components inside. But we think that all of these events eventually impinge upon the cyclic AMP pathway, where activation of pKa can lead to the phosphorylation of complexin. Complexin phosphorylation can essentially flick a switch at a synapse, going from a state where there's low spontaneous fusion to a state where there's now dramatic increase in spontaneous fusion. We think this may, in fact, be a tagging mechanism. The ability of these synapses to generate second messengers from a brief activated stimulus that can lead to a long-lasting change structurally in these connections. And with that, I'll sort of thank the people that have done the work. A lot of the early physiology in this system was done by Motojiro Yoshihara, who really worked out the plasticity pathways. a graduate student in the lab, Bill Dawson, spent a lot of time knocking out all the synaptic tagments and first made the observation that SID4 was postsynaptic. Sarah Huntwerk, another graduate student in the lab, has done all the work on the presynaptic complexins. And Cindy Barber has been sort of following up the work on looking at the activity-dependent growth processes that are triggered through SID4. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention and be glad to take any questions. In SID4 mutants, there's not much of a change in mini amplitude, for example. In the complexin mutant, it's a bit difficult because the fusion rates are so dramatic, you essentially get synapses, events piling up on each other. We could do that at low temperature where we can actually decrease the mini frequency. But in terms of... Yeah, so I think it's just preferential traces. In general, there's no change in mini amplitude after these early events. One of the first things when we saw this postsynaptic synaptic tagmin 4, one of the features of mammalian plasticity is the trafficking of glutamate receptors in and out of the synapse. And this would be a very elegant system for looking at trafficking of glutamate receptors. But there's no evidence that glutamate receptors are present at these synapses. There's only about 20 active zones in total that we're looking at. And this is really a 100 to 500-fold increase in mini frequency. So there's no way to really get that by insertion of new glutamate receptors. Mm-hmm. So the fly-NMJ is very complicated. So we've been trying to perfect some immuno-EM with our SID4 because they have these enfoldings of the plasma membrane that sort of make it very difficult to figure out what's a vesicle and what's an enfolding of the plasma membrane. And so trying to do immuno-EM now and really figure out what's a vesicle and what's an enfolding of the plasma membrane, it's a bit tricky. So there's lots of membranous structures in the postsynaptic compartment of the fly-NMJ, but defining those of which are what's called the subsynaptic reticulum versus a vesicle is a bit tricky. But in general, the things that we've been able to sort of semi-definitively identify are more in the range of dense core vesicles. They're a little bit bigger structures than smaller synaptic vesicles. Uh-huh.
So what does evoked release look like in the complex mutants?
What does what now?
Evoked release look like.
So in general, at low levels of calcium, evoked release isn't dramatically changed. At high levels of calcium, we see there's a decrease in evoked release. I didn't show you the data, but there's also an increased number of active zones in the complexin mutant. So there's about a 65% increase in the number of active zones, which can account for this, 100-fold increase in minis, but may, in fact, evoked releases essentially is we underestimate how much it's decreased. But there's about a 50% decrease in high calcium. The general idea is we're depleting this, this pool of readily releasable vesicles in a complexin mutant.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so we're doing that right now. Of course, the beautiful experiment will be to, we got these lines generated, we just haven't proceeded to test them just yet. But we have phosphomimetic versions of this and phosphoincompetent versions. And what's really exciting is potentially dissecting the role of pKa-dependent plasticity. Fly pKa is so involved in so many behavioral aspects of plasticity, it really would be quite easy for us to go in and test the contribution of this one site to various forms of plasticity. And that's in progress. Yeah?
Speaking of pKa, it's usually localized by a stable
protein. Right.
Yeah,
we haven't gotten into that at all. Certainly there are many other molecular components that are going to be at play here. We've focused only a few of those guys. But looking at ACAPs would be very interesting to see how that is regulated and tethered to complexin and sort of putting it near the snare complex. Yeah.
So we're looking at your eventual effects on muscle 6 and 7. You showed that there was an increase in the integration of one of them at the expense of the other.
Mm-hmm. Right. So essentially what we've done is we've overexpressed in a wild-type background. So the other muscle does have this SIT4 levels.
Right.
And we're just saying, yeah.
It shows decreased innervation.
It shows decreased innervation. So we really think it's a competitive event, that it's essentially that terminal as it's making its early boutons and essentially establishing that initial synaptic field. Whatever target is responding strongest, it's directing preferentially innervation towards that target. Mm-hmm. Yep, so SID4 is actually very interesting. So the kinetics of using the fluorine postsynaptically are very, very difficult because it's such a small delta F that we measure. Unlike synaptic vesicle fusion presynaptic, when you get a whole bunch of vesicles, you get a nice delta F. These postsynaptic events are really tricky. But in terms of thinking about the calcium, one of the unique features of synaptotagmin 4 is, in fact, that the way it binds calcium is very distinct. So the way these molecules in general bind calcium is they have two of these C2 domains, which poke out five aspartate residues, and those aspartate residues essentially bind calcium ions. And what makes it for unusual, and one of the things that attracted many people to the field, is that mammals have two isoforms of this family, CYP4 and CYP11, and both of those isoforms have a serine in there that essentially in a test tube, when you incubate this with calcium, it doesn't bind calcium. The C2B domain does bind calcium, but not the C2A. And so that sort of got people, a lot of people excited that maybe this was an activity-regulated gene, it might be upregulated, and it might compete for binding of calcium on synaptic vesicles. And so once we figured that this molecule was in fact not on vesicles, it became a little bit fishy. Why in the world is there a serine at this site? And why is that serine conserved all the way from C. elegans through humans? And why normally is there a negative charge here? And so it led to the speculation that in fact this might be phosphorylated. And in flies that appears to be true, that this particular site can be phosphorylated by pKa. And when this site is phosphorylated, essentially you can increase calcium binding. So that's a really, you know, an area that we're exploring now is a way to set threshold levels of plasticity of the synapse, that a synapse that's been silent in the past is going to have a CYP4 molecule that is very poor at binding calcium, and you may need a lot of stimulation to drive retrograde signaling. A synapse that's been very active in the past is likely to have this in a phosphorylated state, but now may only need a little bit of signal input to drive this retrograde signaling. So we're sort of viewing this as a potential threshold model for beginning to think about how the plasticity might be set at different thresholds at synapses based upon activity. But in terms of using a fluorine as a timing device, it's really, really tricky.
I'm sorry, but I don't think I really understood the model of presynaptic release. Mm-hmm. So I just think that there's a docking period, and the connections are involved in holding that the vesicles there.
Mm-hmm.
And that can also to regulate union release.
Right. Right, so it's the complexins. In general, what people think is that certainly there are defects in evoked release, and the general model is that what complexins might be doing for evoked release in that sense is essentially to allow these vesicles to dock and prime and wait until there's a calcium signal. And the biochemical events that work that are not really well worked out between how CYP1 and complexin interact to do that. But one molecular model that has some data supporting it, is that what happens is that complexin essentially prevents access of synaptotagmin 1 to the snare complex. And then when there's a calcium signal, the affinity of synaptotagmin for the snare complex increases, and it boots complexin off. And so what complexin really does is to regulate the accessibility of synaptotagmin 1 to the snare complex. And when complexin is gone, synaptotagmin is actually known to bind the snares even in the absence of calcium. What you happen now is you get this molecular machinery of sibling and driving fusion without any at calcium to sort of trigger this event. Yep. In general, the way we think about what's going on during this retrograde signaling is that complexin gets phosphorylated. We don't yet have biochemical data showing that when complexin is phosphorylated, it can't bind the snare complex. That's all in process, but the easiest way to think about it is that it either modifies how complexin talks to the snare complex or changes the way in which it interacts with the snare complex, and that essentially allows the snares to mediate fusion in the absence of a calcium signal. So the snares form, you get fusion. And so we think of complexin as just being that molecular clamp. And during retrograde signaling, you temporarily remove that molecular clamp, and now you have this huge increase in spontaneous fusion that you don't need an action potential, you don't need calcium influx. It's really an activity-dependent event that can be long-lasting where you don't need further input into the system. So that's sort of the way that we think about what's going on. And if you actually look at evoked responses during this stimulation pulse, they actually go down a little bit because you're depleting the vesicle pool. So during this short time period of 3 or 4 minutes when this max increase in frequency, the evoked release is really going down. So this is not, we think, a change in evoked release long term. We think this is a signal for structural proliferation, and that over many hours as you build new synapses, of course, evoked release changes in a positive direction. But over the short term, we think this is really just a signaling event to activate the machinery that's going to drive the structural changes in the nervous system. Again, there's a lot of work to sort of verify that that model is correct, but that's what the data is pointing to now. Well, certainly, at mature third instar larvae, these postsynaptic vesicles are there. We've done a little bit now using drivers, using our fluorine system and DPM neurons and mushroom body neurons. And there it's a bit more tricky because the molecular axons and dendrites in the fly CNS is a bit of a mess because there's these unipolar neurons everywhere. But they're clearly, if you drive synaptic vesicle fluorines versus SIT4 fluorines, you get different distributions. So I think the basic anatomy of SIT4 vesicles fusing postsynaptically is likely to be true. So we're now doing things with Chip Quinn, looking at the real behavioral plasticity with these molecules. The mammalian SIT4 has been knocked out, and it does have some defects in evoked LTP, and it has defects in behavioral learning. The SIT11 has not been published yet, but apparently it clearly is postsynaptic as well, the mammalian isoform, and those animals actually die very early in development. So my suspicion is postsynaptic fusion in mammals is going to play some role as well. Yep, so you can certainly block the plasticity induction by doing that. We haven't followed the fluorine signal by disrupting calcium signaling. That's a bit tricky to do, but one could design potentially those experiments to do that. But during the activity change itself, we haven't really combined the imaging and the physiology yet to follow these postsynaptic fusion events. Again, it's a bit tricky because the change in fluorescence is so small, but could be done. Yeah, so that, again, is a bit tricky. I mean, in the fly CNS, it's a lot messier than it is at the periphery where we know where these events are. It doesn't look like, in fact, that certain neuromuscular junctions in the fly have these dense core vesicles that release octopamine, another neuromodulator, and there we don't see SIT4 postsynaptically. So it could be that it's only at certain populations of CNS synapses. I wouldn't want to say it's only glutamatergic synapses because that I'm not sure about. I doubt that's true, but it's certain populations that only release dense core vesicles like octopamine and these other components. We don't see these postsynaptic vesicles there.
When you see this trick endosome-like structures, do you think that these meanings are retrieved by this bulk endocytosis?
So that's what my suspicion is. So essentially we have a situation where there's a lot of data suggesting that endocytosis is coupled to calcium in exocytosis. And this is a system where we've decoupled that process because we have all this fusion that's independent of a stimulation. So we think that that's ultimately driving this bulky endocytosis process because, you're essentially losing calcium regulation of endocytosis normally. But it clearly can maintain a very robust pool of vesicles because you can stimulate in these guys till the cows come home and they will maintain release. So that mode of endocytosis is sufficient. And then once you start stimulating, you probably recruit other modes of endocytosis as well. So we never get a depletion in the complexin mutants of vesicles.
Okay. Thanks, Troy.
Thank you very much.